Well, it's great to be back in town. I'm back in town for, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks, and then I'm off to Australia. So I'll be in Australia for a couple of Sundays. But just the past few days, I was in Florida, and I had the chance to speak before. It's either the country's largest astronomy club or the second largest astronomy club. They had over 300 members in their astronomy club, which I thought was quite interesting for Florida, because Florida has no mountains. Although a few years ago, I did get to see Florida's highest mountain. It's in the north part of the state, and it's actually a pile of garbage that they heaped up. But it's a little more than 400 feet above sea level, and that's the highest point of land in Florida. But they did say there's some dark places in Florida where they take all their telescopes. But I think what was interesting is speaking before this astronomy club on the astronomical evidences for the God of the Bible. And what I heard from all the people in the club was, we've never heard this stuff before, which was kind of dumbfounding to me. I mean, they have speakers come on a monthly basis, professional astronomers speak to them, but they said, no, this is the first time we heard anything about the beginning of the universe or the design of the universe for life. And they're all positive. I didn't see any negative reaction at all. So it just shows me how compelling that astronomical evidence is and what it does for people. In fact, several of the astronomers came up to me and basically said, you know, understanding this really makes me think that Christianity's got something going for it and definitely something I want to consider.
Where in Florida was it?
This was in the Tampa area. So, and of course, Navigating Genesis is out. And it's also available as an e-book. It just got released yesterday as an e-book, or Friday, as an e-book on Amazon.com. So you can get both the e-book and the print book. Yes?
Where do these guys set up their telescopes? Because Florida is like one of the most light-polluted states there is.
Well, if you go down to the Everglades, it's pretty dark, if you don't mind the pythons and the the alligators. And the bugs, but no, they've actually go up north of Tampa along the ocean there. They found a site that's quite dark. So, because that's what I asked them, I said, how far do you have to drive to get to a dark site? And they said, oh, about an hour and a half. But, you know, it's a lot different from us. I mean, we do star parties, it's literally 45 minutes from here, and you're at 7,400 feet. And so, even though we have a lot of light here, we are able to get to a place that's reasonably dark, yes.
Don't they have really high humidity? And doesn't that bother their viewing?
Well, I started doing amateur astronomy when I was living in Vancouver. And the thing about high humidity is it gives you good seeing. The transparency may not be that great, but it does give you nice, sharp images. As long as the air is... I mean, if you've got a storm coming in, forget it. Or a storm that's leaving. But if you've got a nice, you know, humid, steady weather pattern, that's really good for getting sharp images, especially on the planets. So, like, living here in California, I've not been able to get a sharpened image on a planet with my 11-inch telescope that I could get with a 4-inch telescope in Vancouver. And just because of the seeing issue. Although you could do really well if you got a smoggy day. I mean, Mount Wilson has now been abandoned by the professional astronomers, a 100-inch telescope, and given to amateurs. Reason why is we cleaned up the smog. And they were using the smog as a tool to get good seeing, because it would trap all the unstable air. But now that we've got these anti-smog laws here, and the air is a little easier to breathe, seeing conditions on Mount Wilson are nowhere near what they used to be. So, the word seeing means how sharp the image is. So, for
S-E-E-I-N-G?
Yeah, seeing, S-E-E-I-N-G. And so our atmosphere is turbulent, and it's the turbulence of the atmosphere that spoils the astronomical images. I mean, that's one reason we put up the Hubble Space Telescope, was to get above the atmospheric turbulence. Well, there's certain places on our planet where that atmospheric turbulence is minimal. And, you know, people will put telescopes there in order to be able to, you know, resolve the double stars and triple stars and see fine details in the planets. For example, I remember in Vancouver, there were nights where I could see storms on the surface of Saturn with a relatively small telescope. Something I've not been able to do here because the scene just isn't as good. So, but if you go to places like Chile and Hawaii, they also have a very good scene. Or if you get up to a high enough elevation. Once you get above 14,000 feet, you can get pretty decent scene. So as long as you can breathe, you're fine. And yes, I did see the NOAA movie. We saw it Friday morning. And if you go on our website, you'll see a review that a few of us gave of the movie. And we're making a very confident prediction that Russell Crowe will not win an Oscar for Best Song. So he actually sings in the movie, but I don't think it's an Oscar-worthy song. So.
Did they deal with any of the issues, like was it worldwide or, you know, how
deep? Oh, they portrayed the flood as global in extent. And they portrayed God as a bad guy, the demons as good guys. So yeah, it departs really far from the biblical text.
Oh, it doesn't.
And, you know, they were trying to get a dramatic story of the interaction between Cain, his wife, and his sons. So they were heightening that drama, putting a lot into the story that's not in the text. And then they had Tubal Cain in there. He was actually a stowaway on board the Ark. So, I mean, it's kind of like watching science fiction. As long as you're willing to, you know, not be too concerned about reality, there might be a story there. But I'll tell you, my critique of the movie was this, is if they wanted a dramatic story of personal conflict and interaction and conflicted, you know, they would have been better to stick with a story in Hebrews. What I could tell is that they'd only read the Genesis text and trying to put together the script. And, you know, the real drama is what you see in the book of Hebrews. And they just kind of dropped that completely and went with a different storyline. Yes.
Because I listened to the podcast, you know, before I went to the movie, and so I was kind of definitely disappointed with the movie. But also, I thought somewhere, and I thought it was in the Hebrews, that it said that Noah had preached for 100 years.
Right.
But it doesn't say that anywhere. There is no verse that says Noah preached for 100 years. It doesn't say that he preached.
First Peter.
Well, yeah. Yeah, in the book of Hebrews, it talks about Lot and Noah as men that were sent by God to minister to a wicked generation. The principle is this. Whenever God pours out judgment wrath upon reprobate humanity, he always sends a prophet first to call them to repentance. And so God did not bring judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah until he first put Lot in the city gate. And what you see in the book of Hebrews is here is this man that was, you know, deeply grieved by all the evil he saw around him. And makes the same comment about Noah, how he was grieved by all the evil around him and how God had him build this ark. And, it, you know, you've got to put Genesis and Hebrews together, because in Genesis is where you get the figure that was 100 years. That's not in the book of Hebrews, but it is in the book of Genesis. It took him 100 years to build the ark. Well, I think you get some implication of that in the book of Hebrews.
2 Peter 5.
2 Peter 5 speaks about him preaching, right? A preacher of righteousness to his wicked generation. 2 Peter 2, 2 Peter 3, Hebrews 11, and Genesis 6 through 9 are the texts you need to go to get the whole story. And that was my kind of critique of the movie. It's clear all they looked at was the Genesis text. And if they looked at the other texts, I think they would have gotten plenty of drama for their script. But instead, they just looked at Genesis and said, well, there's not much here on the personal interactions of the people. You know, let's kind of, you know, build a script here. But often with Hollywood is they missed the real drama. I think they could have put together a much more dramatic story if they'd actually gone to these other texts.
I think one of the main points was that, and I'll I didn't hear the podcast. My wife has that seemed to be inferred in the podcast that the Bible says Noah preached for 100 years, almost quote by quote.
Yeah.
And the Bible doesn't do that. The Bible, there's a strong, you could draw a very reasonable conclusion from the various passages in Scripture that he did do that. But there's no explicit statement that says that.
No, there's no explicit statement, but it certainly is a strong inference that he did that. And, you know, I do recognize you've got to put the Second Peter passages in there to get that comment. And you've got to go back to Genesis to get the fact that it lasted 100 years.
Correct.
Yeah. And so, and you know, you can imagine, here's this guy building a gigantic boat, taking 100 years to build it. And he didn't need the watchers to help him build the ark. 100 years is a lot of time. But the whole point is it would have certainly gotten people's curiosity. Why are you building this aircraft carrier sized boat in a place where it doesn't rain? There's no water anywhere around here. And here's this guy building an ark. And let me tell you why I'm building the ark. And I think to give Noah credibility in his preaching, and again this is missing in the movie, is the reason why I'm making this ark so big is that if any of you repent, I got passage for you. But everybody turned him down. Just like the thing with Lot. I mean, God was prepared to rescue whatever righteous people were there in the city. But it was clear there was less than 10. And even the sons-in-laws turned down the offer. And so this is kind of, and basically what the biblical texts are telling us, God is saying, let me show you just how wicked these people are. Now, here you got Noah making an offer of redemption and rescue for a 100-year period, and nobody took him up on the offer. It was just the three sons, their wives, his wife, and that was it, and the animals. So I think that would have been a really dramatic point to make in the story. And notice what it tells us, too, in the text, that he is one of the three most righteous men of the Old Testament era. And you know, God called him to save him. So the movie kind of makes the point that Noah is convinced that God wanted to exterminate all of humanity, including him. Yes? We've not seen God is not dead, but the author of that consulted with me for several days in writing.
It was amazing.
It was good. I mean, it was a little corny in places, but of all the apologetics, you know, in the secular movies, it was good. It gave some good lessons, and it had your science.
Yeah, he took the science from us, so he consulted with us.
What's his name? Bryce
Burroughs or something? Brooks? Bryce Brooks, right. Rice Brooks, pardon me.
You know, and then put it on, because they're talking about it on O'Reilly and all the talk shows, and it would be good to put a review on it for you.
It's really good.
Well, he wants us to endorse the movie. We're a little bit reluctant about endorsing the movie because of the way it portrayed the science professor, or the philosophy professor, and kind of makes the same mistake I see the Discovery Institute making, that there's all these anti-God professors at these secular universities. And, you know, if I were counseling that student how to reach out to his professor, I would have given him very different advice. Right, but you don't want to embarrass or challenge your professor in front of your fellow students. You want to do it privately.
Well,
so,
I don't think he tried. I thought it was great. I didn't think he did it in a bad way. He did it with facts, and because the guy...
It was good content, good material. I'm just a little bit nervous about encouraging young people to take on their professors with that approach.
Well, in the context of the movie, it wasn't him that did it. Professor that forced him to do it.
Right.
How realistic that would be.
Well, that's it.
I don't know, but so.
Yeah, professors don't do that.
In context, he either had the lead with his tail between his legs or publicly defend. So,
well, what I would counsel students in that sitting meet, it was extreme. I can't imagine a professor doing that. But even if a professor did, you'd go to him privately. And that's kind of Matthew 18. Rather than publicly embarrass him or try to make a public incident about it and get yourself kicked out of the university, Matthew 18, you go to the person one-on-one. And if he's not approachable, I mean, if the professor is snarky and blows you off, then you come back with two or three students with you. And then you can appeal. And by the way, this happened to me when I was at the University of British Columbia as an undergraduate. We had a physics professor, different context, but a week before Christmas, he gave all of us 100 physics problems to solve, okay? And we had to hand them in Christmas Eve, all right? And he was in his office Christmas Eve to take these assignments. Well, I got mine done, but you know, it was about 105 pages to show the solutions for all these problems. And we literally worked night and day to get them done. I think there was only three of us that handed them in on time. The rest of the students were handing them in like the day after Christmas. And basically, they're working all through Christmas Day trying to get this done. Well, here's what he did. When you handed it in, he gave you another assignment that was due Christmas Eve. So, anyway, what happened is two students went to the professor and said, you know, we're supposed to get a Christmas break. And these problems were very challenging. And, you know, we learned a lot from doing them. But, you know, you could show a little more mercy towards us than ruining our entire Christmas break by loading us up with this stuff. And by the way, each of us has got 7 other courses that we need to get ready for in terms of the next semester. And we're basically having to drop all of our other class assignments to focus on what you've done. Well, he wouldn't listen to us. And so those two students came back with 5 students and talked to him. Now, none of these students were Christians, and I wasn't part of this. And still, he wouldn't respond. Well, at that point, they got a professor, another professor to go with him. He still wouldn't respond. And at that point, they took it to the chairman of the physics department and said, this is what's going on. And he says, yes, he did something almost that bad the year before. He says, I will talk to him. Well, he wound up getting fired. Now, I learned a lot of physics from this professor, but also I learned that physics professors love to torture their students. So, and often what I tell people is, you know, my role as a professor is to make my students suffer, but not to make them suffer too little or too much. In other words, if I don't make them work a little bit hard, they're not going to learn anything. But if I make them work too hard, I'll discourage them. And basically, they'll give up on me and abandon the whole thing. And that's what was happening. These students were dropping out of physics and saying, I'm going to register in some other department. I'll take up engineering rather than put up with this. And that's where the chairman of the physics department intervened. He went to the professor and says, you're actually causing students to leave this department, not come to this department. So anyway, that's a good example of, you know, our whole class could have yelled at the professor, but that would not have been good. I mean, the way we did it, or the way my colleagues did it, says I wasn't involved. But having looked back on it as a Christian, I said they did it the right way. This is the best way to try to get the professor to change his ways without losing face. But the fact that he kept turning it down meant that he was not willing to listen to any appeal.
Could you, though, in your critique, say it like that? That was the one thing we do. You don't have to give it good and bad. You give it good where it's good and bad where it's bad. And at least you're showing that you're putting a critique, and then we learn.
Sure.
You know, you don't believe professors are that bad, and that was a little exaggerated, et cetera.
Well, you know, Rice contacted me and wanted me to watch the movie, read the book, and do that very thing. I just told him, look, I'm in the middle of writing a book with a really tight deadline. For me to take time off and read all this stuff, watch the movie and write a critique, it means I'm not going to make my contract. I'm under contract right now to put out a book on the history of light. And, you know, our editors want 9 months to edit my book, which means I got to deliver it by the end of September. So, yes?
Well, that professor that made you hand in those assignments, was he an atheist?
He was not a Christian. And
he wasn't Jewish, was he?
He wasn't Jewish, no. He never told us what he... But it was very clear that he was not a believer. I think he would have probably described himself as agnostic if he was pressed. But I could tell just from the very first day I was in his class, this man is really proud. Because the first lecture he gave, he told us how we should have won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of the laser. And it's true that he was part of the original team that was doing laser research, But I didn't think that he deserved the Nobel Prize as much as the guy who actually won the Nobel Prize. Maybe he should have gotten an honorable mention. But he also made it very clear.
He had a lot of pride, huh?
Right. Well, he definitely saw himself as the smartest and best professor in the physics department. University of British Columbia. And, you know, I heard that and I said, well, wait a minute. Our chairman was the one who worked with Oppenheimer to discover the physics of black holes. I mean, that was all done back in 1938. Volkoff and Oppenheimer, you know, to this day, their paper is cited. And that was the chairman of our physics department. And I said, you know, how can this man think that he's a whole lot more brilliant and of greater stature?
One thing about this movie that I did think was accurate is this professor who was an atheist didn't come to that by rational thinking. He was emotionally hurt, grew up as a Christian, and that's typical of an atheist. So,
well, I remember sharing that with Rice, just saying, if you're going to go with this, make sure that you come across with the fact that, yes, it is true, because that was his feeling. All atheists have a father issue, or they've been hurt by Christians. But the whole point is, they're not going to be able to reveal that to you until you deal with their intellectual objections first. That comes first. You have to build a relationship with them through removing their intellectual barriers, and then privately, they may reveal the real reasons why they take this atheistic worldview perspective, and perhaps you can help them forgive.
I think that's how it...
Yeah, it did get that part in there, so I'm glad to see that, because, you know, in Matthew 7, it says, God will not forgive you if you will not forgive others. And a lot of atheists I've met, that's their big problem. I remember spending 2 hours with an atheist at the Iowa State University, and he basically said, you know, I'd like to be able to forgive Dwayne Gish, but I can't. And it says, well, the problem with that is Dwayne Gish has not hurt you as much as you've hurt the creator of the universe. And you're basically saying that, you know, you've been hurt more than God who suffered on the cross. And is that really rational? He says, I admit it's not rational, but I still can't forgive Dwayne Gish. So, and a lot of people are stuck with that. And by the way, that happens in a lot of families. People have been deeply hurt. I'd say about 80% of the atheist scientists I've debated have been altar boys in the Catholic Church, and very few of them are willing to talk about their experience. But I can always tell something happened there.
Did you say that the atheists generally have a problem with their fathers growing up, a relationship with their fathers? I want to make sure I understand.
Well, there's a book put out by Paul Vitz. He's a Christian psychiatrist and psychologist. And he wrote, I forget the title of his book, but the theme of the book is virtually every atheist has had a problem with his father. And if you can help them, you know, help talk to them about their father issues and how they've been disappointed by their father. And the whole point is, you know, God is called the Father of us all. And a reflection of God the Father is our earthly fathers. And if our earthly fathers do not portray a good image of God, then that can really be a stumbling block for us giving our lives to the one that created the universe.
Well, then is that, I mean, I'm not ashamed of it. I just didn't have a great relationship with my father. So would that be a stumbling block for me that even though I can rationally look at things and say, well, this kind of makes sense, but in my heart, I can't really seem to go there.
Well, the book by Paul Vitz, sorry, I don't remember the exact title. Faith of the Fatherless, that's the title of the book. He basically makes the point, we all got father issues. Has any of us ever had a perfect father? No. All of our fathers have disappointed us. The whole point is, are we going to let that be a barrier into our being able to develop a relationship with our fellow man and with the creator of the universe?
So I can't use that as
a lot of people try. But we shouldn't, yes.
You said Noah was one of three righteous people in the Old Testament. Who are the other two?
Abraham and
Moses. Well, that's a good question. Let me ask all of you, who are the three most righteous men labeled in the Bible? Book of Ezekiel is where you're going to find the list of the three most righteous.
Jonah.
Noah is one of them. That's it. Daniel, Job, and Noah are listed as the three. And if you read the story of Job and Daniel and Noah, they're the three individuals you see in the Bible that are described in the biblical text as having the greatest moral character and fiber. So, I mean, they're all sinners. But, you know, when you read the book of Daniel, you really see nothing bad said about him in terms of his personal character attributes.
What about Moses and Abraham?
Well, that's the difference. Okay, you look at Joseph, you look at Moses, you look at Abraham. The biblical text describes significant sin problems they had to overcome. Whereas with respect to Job and to Noah and to Daniel, yeah, they were sinners. But it's not like there was some glaring sin problem that they had to overcome.
So King David's definitely out of the picture.
David's out of the picture. Although, look what the text says about David. A man after my own heart. And let me just say this for all of you. What made David a man after God's heart? He was honest with God and came to him with his questions. I mean, read the Psalms. David is yelling at God at many times and angry with God. But he's angry with God and yelling at God because he's so bent on getting answers from God. And that's why God said, this is a man after my own heart.
Who wrote that? Who wrote God? David is after a man after God's heart? Who actually wrote that? It wasn't King David. Wasn't it?
Well, David's responsible for about half of the Psalms. And Moses wrote a few. And the others, we really don't know who wrote them. So probably some priestly figure is responsible for the others.
Did Aaron write any?
Not that we know of.
No.
So, but yeah, I mean, that's where I think the movie really got it wrong, because they really portrayed Noah as a man who had serious moral issues. But the Bible says, you know, that God found Noah righteous in his eyes. Says that right in Genesis 6. He was the one man. Because God went and looked at humanity and says, what have I done creating this race of individuals who has stooped to such a level of wickedness? But there was one that stood out, and that was Noah. And that's something I said in our podcast. A measure of your righteousness is how well your righteousness is displayed when you're surrounded by evil. It's a lot easier to be righteous when you're surrounded by righteous people. A lot more challenging when you're surrounded by people that are not righteous. And notice it refers to Lot as a righteous man in the book of Hebrews. And yet, look what happened to him. But it also makes the point, there's a limit to how much you can expose yourself to wicked and reprobate behavior before it begins to impact you as well. I mean, in the book of Romans, Paul refers to reprobate humanity as a malignant tumor. It's like a malignant cancer. And if you get too close to it, it will infect you. And that's kind of the story of Lot. He was so close to it for such a long period of time, it was beginning to infect him. And that's when God says, it's time to perform surgery. Lot, you need to get out of here. If you stay here, then it's going to consume you as well. And that's part of, you know, Noah building the ark, saying, okay, if I don't do something, then even Noah and his family are going to be impacted by this wickedness. But one reason why Noah is referred to as such a righteous man is he was able to sustain his righteousness in the face of all the wickedness going around him. Yes?
In Genesis 6, going back to Noah, it says that the sons of God married with these wicked women, and so I want to know who these sons of God were.
Well, if you watch the movie, there are these rock-like transformer creatures, but... I mean, that's another critique I had of the movie. It's like, okay, pick a genre. Is it going to be science fiction? I mean, is it going to be a Transformer movie? Is it going to be a romance? Is it going to be an action movie? But they try to do all of those. And I says, well, I think I know what they're doing. They're trying to appeal to every possible audience they can find, but then it's really hard to weave the story together. But that's just my own personal comment on that. The Apocrypha talks about two different kinds of fallen angels that came down and, you know, inhabited the earth with human beings. But the Bible only speaks of one. And these are the sons of God that come down and have physical intercourse with the daughters of men. It says these fallen angels saw these women, that they were beautiful, and they took them as their wives, and they had offspring by them, the Nephilim. Now, if you get the Genesis question, there's an entire chapter in the, pardon me, the Navigating Genesis book that's just released. I got an updated chapter on the Nephilim. And there's three different theories on the Nephilim. That these sons of God are fallen angels, very wicked angels, who physically impregnated the women that they chose and had the Nephilim as offspring from them. Another model is that these are men who impregnated these women, but they were demon-possessed. And then a third theory is that God had commanded the sons of Seth not to marry the daughters of Cain. But these certain sons of Seth disobeyed God's command and married the daughters of Cain and had these offspring, which are the Nephilim, making the point that the daughters of Cain are incredibly wicked, and by taking them as their wives, this is the end result. So, but you're going by just a few verses in the Bible. Well, and kind of what I do in the book is I tell you where you can go outside of Genesis to get some insight on the Nephilim and the sons of God. But if you just stick to the Genesis 6 text, these are the three different models that you get. However, some counters against all this is that nowhere in the Bible do you see a command given to the sons of Seth to leave the daughters of Cain alone. That's not in the text. But there are texts that say that the angels don't marry. And so that's a problem by saying these fallen angels took these wives and married them. Well, the response to that is, yes, it does say that they don't marry, but that's a reference to the righteous angels. It doesn't say they can't marry, just that they don't marry. So that's kind of the background for the debate. But what I do in the book to help you with the debate is say, here are all the passages in the Bible that talk about sons of God and children of God. By the way, the two terms are synonymous. Sometimes in English, it's children of God. Other times, it's sons of God. But to contrast that with all the passages in the Bible that talk about sons of men and children of men, you will see a difference. Now, the reason for doing that is the term sons of God can either mean angels or humans. So the question is, which is it in the text? But by doing this word study of all the passages in the Bible, what I do in the book is actually give you them all. You don't have to run to your concordance. It's all there in the book. And then we also ask you to do a similar word study on Jesus. Look at all the places he's referred to as Son of Man and all the places he's referred to as Son of God and see what's going on.
Another thing is to consider what they meant by Mary in those about the angels and fallen angels.
Right.
Well, taking the wife as we think of as a permanent attachment as opposed to just having intercourse with them or some lesser.
Well, it's in the context of all of us humans where we're told that when we get to the new creation, we're not going to marry. We're not going to reproduce. We don't need to because the physics is going to be so different. But again, it doesn't mean that we can't do those things. It's that we won't do those things. And so I think that's an appropriate way to look at the angels. Yes, they can do it, but they don't do it. But see, that's a reference to the righteous angels where it says they don't marry. The evil angels, they're disobeying God all over the place. So, and I can tell you, one thing I've learned from my experience in the dealing with demonology and demon-possessed people, the demons seem to be incredibly obsessed about sex. So this idea that they don't care about sex, I don't think can be supported. Any expert in demonology will tell you that, you know, sexual immorality is at the very core of demonic interaction with human beings. Yes.
Is there sex in heaven?
That's what we're told, that in Revelation 21 and 22, we will not be engaging in sex in heaven.
Ah, heaven, I'm in heaven.
Well, if you get my book Beyond the Cosmos, I got a little subsection there titled Better Than Sex. Okay? You might want to read that.
I think I will. So,
I mean, if heaven is better than sex, it's got to be pretty good, right?
I'm sorry, what?
I said, if heaven is better than sex, it's got to be a pretty good place to go to.
Well, I hope my damn well gets I hope.
All right, enough of the humor here. Okay. Anyway, let's jump into the lesson I intended. I mean, we've been kind of stuck on this frozen precipitation for some time, so let me see if we can plow through it. And this is actually relevant to this discussion about the flood. Because I think one way to, and you'll see this in the book Navigating Genesis, you really can't make sense of the Genesis flood story unless you're dealing with a lot of frozen precipitation in the region of the flood. Why do I say that? Because the floodwaters rise up for 5 months, and for 7.5 months they subside. That 7.5 month period for the subsiding of the waters is a long time. Now, we've seen similar floods, not of the same magnitude, but floods here in North America that last 4, 5, 6 months. But the only way they can last that long is through snow and ice melt. If you don't get the snow and ice melt, then the water simply goes out to the ocean, and the floodwaters are taken care of fairly quickly. So, for example, there was a flood in the Mississippi Valley 50 feet deep a few decades ago, about 2 decades ago, and it lasted over 4 months. The reason why it lasted so long, that winter there was a very heavy snowpack on the mountains of North America. And a lot of that snow went into the Missouri and Mississippi River. So even though water was flowing out into the Gulf of Mexico, the water that flowed out was replaced by water from snow and ice melt. Well, likewise, if you look at the region of the Persian Gulf and Mesopotamia and the plains of Arabia, they're surrounded by mountains. And if those mountains have lots of snow and ice on them, and, you know, if it rains for 40 days and 40 nights in a torrential pattern, it's just like here in California. If we get 10 inches of rain here in the Los Angeles area, you know you're going to get 100 inches of snow in the mountains surrounding us. And that snow is going to take a long time to melt, which is why we actually have creeks around here that flow 12 months of the year. The reason why they flow 12 months of the year and the waterfalls run for 12 months of the year, even though it only rains for a few days, is because of the snow melt. So as long as, you know, like you go to Mount San Gorgonio, 11,500 feet high, well, there's a creek that runs off of that that runs all year long. Why? Because there's snow 12 months of the year on the top of Mount San Gorgonio. So, and the reason why you couldn't have a flood as recent as, say, 6,000 years ago, which is kind of the traditional story of the flood of Noah, that it was just thousands of years ago. If it's only 6,000 years ago, where's the snow and the ice? Because if you go to the mountains surrounding the Persian Gulf and Mesopotamian Plain, the only place where you got permanent snow and ice is Mount Ararat. That's it. And there's not a lot there. And that's enough to feed the rivers of the Tigris and the Euphrates, but that's it. There's certainly not enough to sustain a 7.5 month receding of the waters. But if you got the mountains of Arabia and Iran and Turkey,
Armenia.
Well, Armenia still has snow and ice on it, but that's the only region. If all the other places have lots of snow and ice, then you can explain why this flood lasted so long. And actually, I think we're talking a lot of snow and ice, because what does the text say? So much water was flowing into the plain that God had to send a strong wind to help evaporate the water. So the water was removed through water flowing out into the Indian Ocean, but also through evaporation. Even so, it took 7.5 months before there was dry ground and you could leave the ark. Okay. We were mentioning that we have the reference in Psalm 147 and 148 to God blessing the earth with water and snow. Job 37, we looked at the text. Remember when we had that little study here? We found 16 different kinds of precipitation mentioned in Job 37 and Job 38, both liquid precipitation and frozen precipitation. But these are the three main kinds of frozen precipitation: snow, frost, and hail. But there's two kinds of permanent buildup of that precipitation, and what you see in Job 37, it refers to ice And I would translate being from Canada as a reference to ice fields. I mean, here in the United States, the 48 states, you have hanging glaciers. But in Canada, we've got ice fields, not just glaciers, but ice fields. And I believe that's what Job 37 is referring to. Then it also refers to the frozen surface of the deep. That would be, no, I'm not talking permafrost, we're talking the Arctic ice cap, in which you've got in Antarctica. In other words, where you actually have ocean water that's permanently covered in ice. Now, you say, how did the people in Job's time know about all that frozen surface of the water? Well, I'll tell you, it was a lot colder at the time. And therefore, if you look at, I don't know if you ever took these grade 5, was it grade 5? They studied geography here in California, or grade 6, and they show you a map, and they show you a place where you have the farthest north ice, and then the farthest south of where you've got ice for part of the year. There are regions of our planet that are ice-bound literally 12 months of the year. And that's kind of the polar limits, South Antarctica and the Arctic. And then there's regions for example, the port of Halifax is not an ice-free port. There are times of the year where that port is frozen. So that's an example of a fairly far south port here in North America that is not ice-free. But if you go up a little further to some of the ports on Baffin Island, they're ice-bound 12 months of the year. And so this is kind of the picture of what we're being talked about here. Now, we've already done a study on We've already done a study on the snow. I'm not going to repeat that. And the frost and the hail. And the snow, frost, and hail is a reference to what you get literally all over the planet. There's really nowhere on planet Earth where you don't get some form of frozen precipitation. In fact, I can remember back in the 1980s where we got 5 inches of hail in one day where in our townhouse in San Dimas. So, and it was warm outside. You know, we went outside, it was probably 60 degrees. And you can get a lot of hail when it's warm here, as long as it's below freezing up in the high atmosphere. And it was such we literally got 5 inches covering our streets and our backyard. That can happen, even in a place as warm as Los Angeles. And by the way, it happens in Ecuador. It happens in Peru. So even when you're close to the equator, that can happen. And as we mentioned, you can get frost when the temperature is above freezing. That happens here in California all the time. So yeah, if you want to do an experiment and you see frost in your backyard, take a thermometer and go outside and don't be shocked if it says 38 degrees or 39 degrees. As long as it's below freezing on the surface of the plant, you can get frost. You say, does that really happen? Yes. The ground temperature, the temperature on the surface of the plant and the air temperature can be completely different. They can vary by several degrees. But then there's those places on planet Earth where you've got permanent ice and permanent snow. So, for example, if you want to have crops in the San Joaquin Valley, you're going to need mountains where you've got permanent snow and ice. And that's the wonderful thing about living in California. We have this mountain range, the Sierra Nevada Mountains, where you've got ice and snow that stay there 12 months of the year. And the melting of that snow and ice as it accumulates over the winter and melts during the summer is basically what allows us to have all the fruits and vegetables that we're able to consume. You know, our state of California is number one in terms of the production of food. And that's simply because we got the Sierra Nevada Mountains. If we didn't have those mountains and didn't have that permanent snow and ice, we wouldn't be able to grow all the crops we do here. And we couldn't have, you know, 38 million people living here in California. You know, it's amazing to me as a Canadian, there's more people living in California than there is in the entire country of Canada. So, but it's because of all the ice and snow we got here that that's possible. So, hey, when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for all the ice and snow in the Sierras so that you can have green beans as part of your Thanksgiving meal.
You actually have to be thankful for the earthquakes. I used the earthquake this last week, and it was a great lesson to talk about thanking God for even earthquakes for making our mountains.
Yeah.
Yeah. Earthquakes make mountains. I keep telling my sons, right now we're a little under 1,200 feet elevation where we live, but if we stay there long enough, we'll be owners of a mountain resort property. It'll be a while, but the ground keeps moving up. In fact, we are living in the one location, well, we rank second. The Himalayas are first in terms of increasing elevation. But these San Gabriel Mountains are second in the world for most rapid uplift growth. Those mountains are going up 9 millimeters a year. Yeah. Himalayas, 17 millimeters a year, which is why Sir Edmund Hillary did not climb the world's highest mountain. It's now nearly a foot and a half taller than when he first climbed it. So, but these mountains, too, you've probably noticed that the longer you keep climbing these mountains, the harder it is to climb them. But hey, that may have more to do with your age than it does what's happened to the mountains. So, but let me give you some examples of what I'm talking about in terms of frozen ice and snow and what it can do in terms of allowing us human beings to be able to inhabit it, the entire, God told Adam and Eve and he told Noah. That's in the movie where God says to Noah, multiply and fill the earth. There's no way we humans can multiply and fill the earth if we don't have permanent snow and ice. It takes a permanent snow and ice, and it's slow melting. And that's one of the properties of water. When it's in a frozen state, it takes a lot of energy to melt a block of ice. So, and I'll just give you a quick number. Okay, you can take some water, liquid water, and raise that liquid water from 33 degrees to 34 degrees. Okay, you're going to need 80 times as much energy to raise it from 32 degrees frozen to 32 degrees liquid. So that's one of the properties of water. It takes a lot of energy to turn it without raising the temperature at all from a frozen state to a liquid state, which is why you can have it 90 degrees as you hike around the high Sierras. It can be 90 degrees outside and there's snow all around you.
How do you explain the islands of Puerto Rico and Hispaniola, where they have no snow and ice?
Well, if you're in a place where there is no snow and ice, the only way you're going to be able to maintain a large population is if you've got a lot of rain coming down. But, you know, the average rainfall for the entire surface of the earth is something like 30 inches. And there are a lot of places where we get a lot less than that. I mean, California is a prime example. What's the average rainfall in the LA area? 13 inches a year. 13 inches a year is not enough to sustain crops for a large population. And so you either get that water from snow melt, or you're going to need to say, we got to move and go to a place that's a lot wetter. But, you know, the island examples you gave, Hispaniola, they get a whole lot more rain than we do. And so they can grow crops, intense crops, because of the rainfall. So if you're in a dry place, you better have snow or ice or you're in trouble. So any place where you've got a dry climate without snow and ice, nothing grows. Or at least nothing grows that can feed a large population. Yes?
Did you say it takes a lot more energy to melt the ice than or to get it into the ice?
Okay. It takes 80 times as much heat energy to take water from 32 degrees centigrade or 32 degrees Fahrenheit frozen to 32 degrees Fahrenheit liquid. So you're not even raising the temperature at all. You're just taking it from a frozen state to a liquid state. That takes 80 times more heat energy than to take liquid water from 32 degrees and raise it to liquid water of 33 degrees. That's the difference.
So the ice, I guess, absorbs much more energy before it's...
Well, that's a property of every element or every liquid, is that it will take more energy to get it from the frozen state to the liquid state and liquid state to the vapor state. But water is at the top of the pile. And just how much energy it takes to change it from frozen to liquid and liquid to vapor. I mean, it's even more extreme when you're taking it from liquid to vapor. And all of that's crucial for sustaining a stable water cycle here on planet Earth. If water didn't have those properties, we wouldn't be able to sustain the population of animals and plants that this planet is able to sustain.
It does take the same amount of energy to go either direction on that phase change, though.
Well, yeah, if you want to go from liquid to frozen, yeah, it is the same amount of energy. You've got to remove that much energy. Yes?
I'm curious. I'm getting a little bit into backyard gardening. And I'm seeing some people post that since it's so dry out in California, it's a good thing to catch rainwater.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say that government officials don't want you to catch rainwater. What would be the purpose of that?
We have a new invasive species of mosquitoes, the tiger mosquito that's infesting Los Angeles, and there's a lot more lethal.
Right.
And the rainwater, I mean, all of us should do this. After these rains, you should go in your yard and look, because just a spoonful of stagnant water can house a million mosquitoes.
So that's the difference between a swimming pool. So I was thinking, why?
Yeah. Swimming pool, obviously, with those mosquitoes, if you maintain it. If you don't maintain a mosquito, oh my gosh, you can imagine how many mosquitoes you can bring into a swimming pool.
Okay.
Your neighbors that bring swimming pools, I report them to authorities, because they could breed billions of mosquitoes that infest your whole neighborhood. Yeah.
Okay.
Dengue and other kinds of mosquito-borne diseases.
Yep. Yeah. So yeah, keep that chlorine in your pool.
Yeah.
Keep the mosquitoes out.
Even if you're not swimming in the winter.
Yeah. Okay, let's see if we can move on with this lesson since we're rapidly, the time's going by. Here's some slides I've got here, what I'm talking about with permanent frozen water. This is a slide, maybe we can dim one of the lights if it might help. Some lights right behind you there, thank you. Especially if we can dim these, but we'll see. Or you can see it over here. This is Lake Louise in British Columbia, just above the American border. And when I was a teenager, that glacier you see up there came all the way down to the shore of the Lake Louise. In fact, I can recall as a teenager walking around that lake, and I would see women in high heels walking on the glacier. Not a good idea. So, and it's because it was so close to a famous hotel, which is right in front of this particular photo here. But as you zoom in here, you can kind of get a better picture of the ice here. And by the way, you think there's no glacier here. The glacier comes down about here. But on top of the glacier is a lot of gravel. Just below that gravel, you've got a moving glacier. And the glacier's coming from around that corner there. And this is a shot of what it looks like when you get sufficiently up the trail, and you can just see just how much ice is pouring down this valley and down into the lake. But it's been warm for the last 50 years, and therefore this glacier is nothing like what it was even a few decades ago. And that's just because this area gets exposed to temperatures in the 80s, and over a period of several decades, that can melt a lot of the snow and the ice. Now, this part here will never melt. Why? Because it's shaded. The sun really doesn't shine in that area. And by the way, they got a name for this. That's called the death trap. Because people actually try to walk up to the top of that thing. And for good reason, they've actually got a climbing hut at the top there. At the very top, you can see a little tiny rectangle. That's a three-story climbing hut. If you want to climb those mountains, that's what you do. You go up the death trap, and then you climb the different mountains on either side. But they call it the death trap because those crevasses are about 500 feet deep. And one wrong step, and you fall down into the crevasse, and the likelihood of getting you out uninjured is not very high. But here's some other examples. And what's interesting, and these are all ice fields that are not that far above the U.S.-Canada border. So we're just talking a couple hundred miles or less of these. And this is what's called a valley glacier, where, like here in the United States, the 48 states, you will see glaciers, but they're typically hanging glaciers, where you get a little bit of snow and ice that clings to the steep side of a high up mountain. But this is an example of a valley glacier, where the glacier is actually a flowing river of ice. Say, how fast does it flow? Well, anywhere from 10 to 15 feet a day, which is why it's not a good, I mean, you look at that glacier and say, well, let's just walk across, but it's moving, and the crevasses open up and close, which is why it's not a good idea to go across it unless you've got, say, six people in your party and you're all roped up, so that when one person falls in, the other five can haul them out. So, And hey, if you're above my weight, you're usually the one that has to go in front. So I've had to do that a few times. Oh, here's a trivia question for you. What is the biggest glacier in the 48 states of the lower 48? Not counting Alaska. Where do we find the biggest glacier?
In Montana.
Montana? Anybody else? Yeah, Montana does have glaciers. But Montana only has hanging glaciers. It does not have a valley glacier. California, that's the right answer. We're the only state in the Union that has a valley glacier.
Where is that located?
Well, go up to a place called Big Pine on the eastern side of the Sierras.
Yeah.
And you go up from Big Pine, up a little road, and you will find a valley glacier. It's the only one in the 48 states. And why it's there? It's surrounded by mountains that are 14,000 feet or higher. It's well shaded, and the glacier itself is at 12,500 feet. But it's 1.5 square miles, so still not very big, nothing compared to these. But it is the one and only valley glacier in the entire 48 states, and it's incredibly far south. So, the Palisades is where you're going to find the valley glacier. And actually, if you want to get on a glacier, that's the safest glacier to get on. It really doesn't have any crevasses in the valley. It doesn't move very fast. That's because it's so well shaded, and it's on a plateau. So yeah, that's where I take people who want to have fun on a glacier, because it's really quite safe, and you get these incredible views. But here's some more examples of glaciers, and this gives you an idea of the rivers of ice that are moving. But this particular great glacier is receding by about 40 to 50 feet a year. So it's getting smaller at a dramatic level. So even though you've got a lot of ice, it is melting. And hey, there's a shot of Kathy being guided up one of these ice fields. So
I will say that regarding that Palisades Glacier and the others along the side of the Sierra Nevada, I go up to the White Mountains across the Owen Valley up there every year for stargazing for a week or so in the summer. And every year I see it, those glaciers receding further and further. It used to be that pretty much covered the entire Sierras 20 years ago, and now you can hardly see any of those glaciers.
That's true. They're still there, but they're nothing like what they were when I was climbing around them in my 20s. So, and by the way, even these Canadian glaciers are getting smaller at a dramatic level. Yes?
What's the literally the coldest place on Earth, period, all year round?
The coldest place on Earth would be probably near or at the South Pole. I mean,
is that habitable? You actually live there all year round?
Well, there is an astronomer, Jody Lamoureux. She's a volunteer. She's a Christian and a volunteer for Reasons to Believe. She spent 2 years there at the South Pole. But she says in the wintertime, you've got to stay indoors. Because if you go outside, it's colder than minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and you've got 100 mile per hour winds. So no matter how you're dressed, you're not going to survive.
What's the type of lodging does she have?
Well, yeah, the heat source is you're basically living in a building on stilts. The reason why they put it on stilts is because the ice level goes up and down, and basically going up. And so if you don't put the building on stilts, within a few years it's completely covered in snow, and then the snow crushes the building, and that's not a good thing for the inhabitants. Pardon me?
How many people live there?
Oh, not a whole lot of people. You're talking maybe a dozen people that might be living there.
That's it?
Well, it depends. In the summertime, you get a few more showing up. But in the wintertime, and there are times when you're only looking at maybe a couple of people. In fact, what Jody told me before, because she spent winters down there, said before they would let me go, I had to take a training course in surgery in case I had to perform surgery on myself. And said, yeah, what they actually trained you to do is how to do surgery where you got a computer and there's a surgeon, say, somewhere at John Hopkins telling you how to operate yourself. And so he says, that was an interesting training experience. Oh, well, they bring in propane tanks. So,
really?
Yeah.
But you can't even fly in the winter.
You can fly in the summertime. And so they bring all the supplies in the summer. And then, so you better pray that nothing goes wrong in the wintertime. Because if it does, there's no one going to... That's what they said. I mean, if you get cancer or you need surgery of some kind, there's no doctor that they can fly in. You got to do it on yourself or get one of your friends to do it. In fact, there was a television documentary where they had two people at the South Pole in the wintertime and one had to perform surgery on the other.
It's a famous book. I can't remember what the name of it.
Yeah.
It's a woman who did it, yeah.
Yeah, it's a woman who did it, right. So, and that's why they like to send young people there, so the probability is a little bit lower that they're going to need medical treatment. In fact, she had to pass a test because she said, you know, if I was overweight, they wouldn't take me. If I wasn't in good health and doing exercise, they wouldn't take me. But she was able to pass the test and to get there. And they say women do a whole lot better than men in terms of being able to handle the isolation. So, and this is an example of an ice fall. So think of a frozen waterfall. That's what's going on here. And ice is tumbling down. And some of these things that tumble and break off are over 100 feet high. So this is in a southern part of British Columbia. This is the southernmost ice field in North America. Again, just like 50 miles above the American border. But this is one of the most dramatic ice rivers that you'll see in North America. And actually, it was with a Caltech climbing crew, and we got to the top of this and kind of looked over. But you don't want to climb that. Climbing that, you're not going to make it. So, but a huge amount of ice just pouring through there. And this is where the Columbia River gets its water from. So it's the melting of this ice field that feeds the Columbia River. And this is another ice fall that's also feeding the Columbia River. So, and this kind of is a close-up of what that ice looks like. And again, every one of those little tiny ripples you see there is several hundred feet high. So gives you an idea of the dimensions of that. And this gives you an idea how steep the ice fall is. So it's just pouring down there. So think of a frozen waterfall that's moving at about 15 feet a day. And but it's because of the ice we have here in North America, we're able to grow all the crops we do. It's basically the melting snow and ice that's taking place in southern Canada and northern the United States of America that allows the North American plains to be able to produce all the food that they do. I mean, we are kind of the premier food exporter, and it's thanks to this ice that we can do that. Yes?
You know, I always wonder, it's, you know, we talk about, like, they have the tar sands up in northern Canada, and they can pipe down crude oils all the way down. But with the water problems we're having in the western United States, it seems like it would be so easy to pipe down water from Canada all the way down to us. And I'm sure all the states coming down, Nevada, Idaho, they would all like to tap into that water because they all seem to have water issues. I mean, is that an issue that's... I mean, why hasn't that been brought up?
Well, that was brought up for the first time in 1958. So it's been a serious proposal. And a serious proposal because it's the melting snow and ice here in North America that's responsible for one-third of the world's fresh flowing water. So this isn't a trivial source. It's huge. And by the way, I'm sharing all this with you so when you come to Thanksgiving, you can thank God for the last ice age. If we didn't have ice ages, we wouldn't have this source of water. And without that source of water, there's no way we could have 7 billion human beings on the face of the earth. And so no ice ages, all you can have is a small human population. Moreover, that human population would have to be localized. God's command to multiply and fill the earth could not be obeyed if we didn't have ice ages. So we're basically the beneficiaries of the melting snow and ice from the last ice age. And the most dramatic example of that is North America. The state of Alaska, British Columbia especially, is where we get this huge store of ice and snow that's melting. and melting at a great...
15,000 years ago?
Pardon me?
That was about 15,000 years ago?
Yeah, the Ice Age was in full force until about 15,000 years ago, which is why I'm critical of the date for Noah's flood as being, say, 6,000 years ago or 7,000 or 8,000 years ago. It's too recent. There wouldn't be enough melting snow and ice to fit the story we see in the book of Genesis, or to fit what we see in Genesis 2 with respect to the Garden of Eden. We have a chapter in that in the Navigating Genesis book. The text says there were four rivers flowing into Eden. Well, only two of those rivers flow today, but all four were flowing at the close of the last ice age. So it means we need an earlier date, something like 20 to 80,000 years ago, to explain the story in Genesis chapter 2. If you're not in the throes of an ice age, then you can't really come up with a consistent interpretation of Genesis chapter 2.
What provides for the physical integrity of ice that's moving 15 feet a year and obviously just deforming and wanting to break and that sort of thing?
Oh, it does break. Okay. I mean, you know, Kathy and I were hiking up here, but that's the ladder we had to go up to get above the glacier. But as you're walking the trail, you can hear this ice breaking off and tumbling down, and rocks are flowing everywhere. You know, that's why you really don't want to get too close to a fast-moving glacier. It's not just the moving ice, it's all the stuff it carries with it. Very dangerous place to be. But to answer your question, yes, people have seriously said, look, North America is the storehouse of all this melting snow and ice. And by the way, and I said, one-third of the world's fresh flowing water comes from North American melting snow and ice from one region only. Guess how much of it we're using for agriculture? Guess how much we're using it to water our cities? 1%? It's actually 0%.
0%.
None of it is being used for agricultural purposes, and we're not using it to water the lawns of our big cities or to take care of our swimming pools or our hot water heaters. I mean, it's basically flowing into the oceans untouched. Yeah. Now, because it's untouched, we actually have significant salmon sources. I mean, once you start damming up all these rivers and exploiting the water, then that's a problem for the fish. And so far what's been happening in North America, we've given greater priority to the fish than we have to harvesting the water for agricultural purposes and for taking care of our thirsty cities. Now, having grown up in British Columbia, it's not either or. You can build kind of diversions where you can have a dam and you can let the salmon kind of bypass the dam. We call them fish ladders. And so there is a way, but you've got to train the fish to use the fish ladders. And by the way, the bears are pretty quick at figuring out the benefit of the fish ladders. They're not dumb. And so you have to actually design the fish ladders in such a way that a significant percentage of the fish can get past the bears. Because, yeah, it's really... I've actually seen these bears sitting on these ladders waiting for the salmon to come up. So... But to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, there's a region in North America called the Rocky Mountain Trench. And this kind of gives you an idea. There's kind of a trench-like region that goes from the Canadian-U.S. border all the way up to the Yukon, past Yukon, all the way up into Alaska. Or I can kind of show it to you this way. You know, there's kind of the Rocky Mountains, but notice right next to the Rocky Mountains is this deep trench. And it is deep. We're talking like 8,000-9,000 feet below the heights of the mountains. And that's where all these rivers flow from that are feeding off the melting snow and ice. So you've got the Columbia River, the Fraser River, the Athabasca River, the Saskatchewan River, the Mackenzie River, Peace River, they all flow from the melting snow and ice of this region. And it literally does add up to one-third of the world's fresh water supply. And right now, it's untapped. Nobody's touching it. And yes, there's been a lot of talk about the water shortage we have here in California, Arizona, Utah, and why don't we tap into that water and bring it south? Say, well, how expensive is that? Well, in 1958 dollars, it would have been $100 billion. to bring all that water south. Today it'd be 10 times that much, but that's still a pretty cheap price to bring water, and would actually allow us to greatly increase our food supply. Why hasn't it been done? There simply isn't the demand for that increased food supply. But the one scenario I can think of, what if something were to happen in terms of an agricultural disaster in China or Europe or India? Then that would put pressure on North America. Hey, North America is the one place where we can significantly increase agricultural activity. You guys have got the water, you got the land, you got to do it, and we're going to give you the money to do it. So that's one scenario where it could happen. But it's also a scenario whereby we could see the fulfillment of Revelation chapter 8. What does Revelation 8 say? A rock from outer space is going to strike the earth and poison one-third of the world's fresh flowing water. There's only one place in the world where you got one-third in one spot, North America. Now, fortunately, not a lot of people live there, so if something big were to strike there and mess things up, there wouldn't be a lot of people dying. But if we were exploiting the water, and if that water became poisoned where it was now producing plants that had too high of a level of metals in it, we could see the fulfillment of Revelation chapter 8. And I can tell it's time for some more announcements. So we'll wrap this up next week with a discussion of why we need highly fine-tuned ice ages in order to have advanced civilization, and why we're living in an ice age that's like no other. There's never been an ice age like the one we're in right now, or the end of an ice age like the one we're in right now. We're living at a unique time in the history of the Earth. Well, I'll give you a little tip. We're living at a time where instead of the temperature of the planet spiking up and sharply dropping down and bringing another ice age, it comes up, levels off, and has stayed level for the last 9,000 years. Has never happened in the history of the Earth. Next week, we'll explain why, and why you need to add that to your Thanksgiving Day list of things to thank God for.